Good morning, Rabotai. Welcome to Breakfast in the Class. Breakfast in the Class is dedicated in loving memory of Mrs. Lily Safra Alaa Shalom, Leinushmat Leah Bat Chana. Her philanthropy has reached so many throughout the entire world. The week of Breakfast in the Class has been sponsored by Eliana and David Shasha's friends in honor of their wedding. That's why there's flowers out on the table. Rabotai, don't get used to them. Okay. Breakfast in the Class is dedicated in loving memory of Suri Alfonso Zanzuri, Leilui Nishmat Suri Ben Clement Viulanda, sponsored by Avram Simmons, and as well, the month of Cobra dedicated in honor of Rachel Saya, donated by her children. My friends, we read about an amazing occurrence in this week's parasha. Vayivater Yaakov levado, vayavek ishimo. Yaakov is ferrying his children across the river. He needs to make sure that he gets away from Esav, that he places some distance between himself and his murderous brother, who is contemplating fratricide. He wants to kill him. He wants to destroy him. He wants to take everything. He wants to kill not only Yaakov, but he wants to kill his wife, his children. Like the pasuk says, I'm worried about my brother. Maybe he'll come. Yavovi kani em albanim. He's going to kill me, men, women, children. So Esav's anger has mushroomed, like anger often does, from the source of its origin, to encompass far more than the thing that it originates with. Oftentimes you're angry at someone and therefore you feel like you want to do something, or you want to get revenge, or you want to take something back, or you want to make him feel what he made you feel, etc., etc., etc. But what have the kids done? What did Yaakov's wives do? What does that have to do with anything? But the answer is, such is the nature of anger that it eventually, unless it's dealt with, it eventually consumes so much more than what it was, where it was originally intended. And one of the lessons that we learn from here in the mushrooming of anger is not only in where the anger is directed at, that you could be angry at a person, now you're angry at his wife, and now you're angry, now the guy's kids can't come to your child's wedding, etc., etc. Not only in the way it's directed at, but also it mushrooms within the person. Think back to the last time you got angry at work. And you try telling me you didn't bring that anger home. You get angry at your dad, next thing you know, you're angry at your mom. Your mom's like, what did I do? Well, you married dad. Yeah, but that was like 50 years ago. And without that, you wouldn't exist. Still, bad decision. Right? You're angry at someone. It breaks this concept of anger. Breaking borders is such a powerful idea that's important to pay attention to. And what I think is something that people often do not realize is that anger and love are not two things which are at odds with one another. You could be angry at someone that you love. And not only that, here's the wild one. Hate and love are not necessarily opposites. And that's something that people don't wrap their heads around that. They feel like, if I'm so upset, I'm so angry at someone, I hate them, that means that I can't also love them. But that's not the way Judaism teaches. You know, in Judaism we have this idea that there's one thing that is appropriate to hate, not even one person, one thing. What is appropriate to hate? Ohavei Adonai sin'ura. Those who love God, they hate evil. They don't hate evildoers. Like the pasuk says in Barachi Nafshi, that David HaMelech says, Yitamu hata'im min ha'aretz, may sins end from upon the earth. Hata'im sins, v'lo hota'im, and not sinners. His anger, his hatred was not directed at the person who had slipped up, who had made a mistake, but rather at the source itself, at the sin itself. This was something that he felt needed to be addressed. And my friends, it cannot be that a person can change something which is bad, which is evil, which is incorrect, unless there's such an aversion, an upset, a rejection of that thing that it causes the person to hate the sin. And I need to illustrate this because I think that this is a very important concept. Okay? This idea of live and let live, of being just non-judgmental, which on the surface sounds like a wonderful thing, it also creates and allows for the proliferation of the worst crimes against humanity to fester and grow beneath the surface. We must be careful in the process of protecting free speech, not to allow for hate speech to grow under the banner of free speech. Your right to speak, your right to emote, your right to have an opinion is paramount, 100%. But what if your opinion is that someone else deserves to be destroyed, someone else is subhuman? What happens in those moments? What happens if the worst thing that happens to someone who says, I like Hitler, and that Nazis are good, and they did some good things, and that Hitler invented, weirdly, highways and microphones, hashtag fact check. What if the worst thing that happens to someone like that is they lose their Twitter account? That's the world we live in. The world we live in says you're not allowed to have an opinion. You're not allowed to say anything is wrong. But in a world where nothing is wrong, my friends, then the worst possible things can be allowed to grow to a point where we then throw up our hands and say, we have no way of dealing with it. It is okay, my friends, to hate evil. You can't perpetrate. You can't identify perhaps that with a person. We always have to believe that people can grow and can come back. Judaism believes in second chances. The concept of teshuvah is one of the fundamental elements of Judaism. But my friends, at the same time, if we cannot call something out when it is inappropriate, where it is wrong, where does that leave us as a society? So let's talk a little bit about what happens with Yaakov. Yaakov is ferrying his children away from his murderous brother. The brother that Yaakov says at the same time, Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad Esav. Save me from my brother, save me from Esav. Because Yaakov was able to understand that this figure was at the once his flesh and blood, but also someone that wanted him dead. I always loved the fact that Yaakov was capable of seeing within Esav both possibilities. He saw within him someone that loved him, but also someone that hated him. And he takes his family and he crosses them over the river. And then as he crosses them over the river, the Pasuk tells us, Yaakov went back one more time after he got everyone across. Reminds me of that riddle with the guy and the sheep and the wolf and the boat going back and forth. Right? Yaakov goes for one more trip back across the river. Vayivater Yaakov levado, and there's no one with him. And he's going to get the last vessels, pachim ktanim, says Rashi, the small vessels that he left behind. And my question always was twofold on this particular twist in the story. Number one, why is Yaakov making a journey back across the river for these small and insignificant vessels? Surely Yaakov Avinu, with his time management, the importance of time management for such a great tzaddik, could understand that this is not worth your time. How cheap was Yaakov Avinu? Number one. Question number two is, why is Yaakov alone? Why does no one go back with him? If the journey was worth making, how come he doesn't take one of his young sons, or many, or of his avadim, or, for that matter, any of the angels that Yaakov had with him, that he was able to freely send towards Esav? My friends, I want to share with you a remarkable story. I don't remember the origin of who it was, but it made such a profound impact, so I want to share it with you. There was a fellow in the community that was causing all sorts of trouble. He'd fallen off the wagon, shall we say. It was causing all sorts of trouble with the local authorities. Now, if you cause trouble with the local authorities, and you're in America, you know, maybe someone comes and writes you a ticket. Maybe they hassle you with the permit, you know. But you cause trouble with the local authorities if you were living in Iraq and Iran and Syria and Russia and Poland. What could happen was catastrophic. So they came to him, they said to the rabbi, "Rabbi, we can't deal with this guy. No one can talk to him. He's ignoring everybody. He's carrying on in these ways. He's a danger to our society. Rabbi, you should pray to God. You should curse him." By the way, before I was a rabbi, I did not realize that was one of the options. You know, there's no, you know, I just imagine a guy going up to the sefer, like, "Misha kila Abraham is that here?" I never had to do a Misha Kilal instead of a Misha Berach. They asked him to curse him. So the rabbi said, "Look, I know what your intentions are. I see what you're doing. I understand the problem." He says, "Give me a day. Come back to me." They come back to him at the end of the day. They're like, "Rabbi, you're a miracle worker. Whatever you did, unbelievable." The guy changed his mind, reversed the process. "We're all good. What did you do? What did you say?" Listen to what the rabbi said. He says, "I focused on the mitzvah of ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, of loving your friend like yourself. And I worked and worked and worked, tried to find something, tried to get to a place where I loved this man, where there was something about him that was lovable. And I felt in my heart the love and kinship and brotherhood that a Jew feels so or is supposed to feel for his brother or sister." And our Chazal tell us, "Kemayim panim el panim," just as water reflects face to face when you look at it, so too is the heart of a man to another man, of a person to another person, that when you love someone, that love is reciprocated toward you back. When you smile, what happens? It's a remarkable thing. New Yorkers are amongst the toughest people on earth. I always imagine, like, what would happen if, like, you had a time machine and took a bunch of New Yorkers and stuck them, like, fighting the Vikings. My money would be on New Yorkers, by the way. Yeah, like, a New Yorker would, like, you know, see a guy running towards him with an axe, they'd hail a cab, run over that guy. I'd imagine, brutal. You make eye contact on the subway, what do you want? And yet, and you can try this, get in any elevator, catch someone's eye, what do? They don't know you, they don't know what you want. Kemayim panim el panim. By the way, come to someone with anger, yeah? What happened? Watch their face. "What are you doing?" Just do that. Or don't do that. You might get punched. "Me? What are you?" Immediately. The chidush here is that this is not only something which is a facial mirroring technology. It applies metaphysically, spiritually, emotionally. You don't even need to be in the same room as the person. That was the chidush here. The man must have felt a little bit different. He regretted what he'd done, so he hit the reverse and he backed out of that situation. My friends, I think what Yaakov was doing here was strategic. Yaakov understood that the challenge that he was having with Esav perhaps had something to do with the fact that there was a hatred in Esav over the Berachot. Now, by the way, Yaakov had purchased the Bechorah fair and square. Esav had willingly given it up to him. The fact that later on, after you make a deal, then the price of the stock goes up, at least in your eyes. Now you come back, you're like, "I want a refund." That's not how it works. Esav says literally, "Lama li, what do I need the Bechorah?" After he sells it, he doesn't even want it. The bracha belongs to Yaakov. But Esav is upset perhaps in the way that it went down. He's upset that you tricked me. I didn't know. And then, you came into dad and you had to do this. You took it that way. You tricked it. And now, what does Esav have? Esav is this secondary being. Esav is something which exists to serve Yaakov. Correct? That's what the Beracha said. V'rav ya'avod tza'ir. Right? Hen gvir samtiv lach. I made him your master. That's what the Beracha said. He made Yaakov Esav's master. And that's why he tells Esav, I wish I could give you another Beracha. I can't. You know why? Because the halacha is, mashakana eved kana rabo. If a servant is walking along with his master and he finds a lost object and he picks it up, whose object is that? It belongs to his master. He acquires it for his master. That's the halacha. So whatever I'm going to give you, Yitzchak says to Esav, is going to belong to him anyway. So Yitzchak gives a beracha to Esav that when the time is right and Yaakov is not doing his job, ufarakta ulo me'alecha. You can take his all, his yoke from upon your shoulders, and then you can rise up against him and throw it off. Throw off that yoke. And we've witnessed the seesaw of Jacob and Esav many, many times. So much so that the Gemara says, if someone tells you that Jerusalem is built and Rome is destroyed, you could believe him. That Rome is built and Jerusalem is destroyed, you could believe him. But if someone tells you that Jerusalem and Rome are destroyed, or someone tells you that Jerusalem and Rome are built, don't believe him. Look at where we are today. Jerusalem rebuilt. Rome, a city of ruins. Wild. But it's not just Rome. The Gemara in Beitzah tells us that Germany was also Germania shel Edom. And that the Nazis were actually descendants of Amalek. Wild to think that. Gemara Beitzah, Germania shel Edom. Think about the fact that Germany is on top of the world post-Holocaust, and almost immediately from a historical perspective, as Germany descends into nothingness, what happens to Eretz Israel? There's a battle, 1940, Battle of Independence, 45, 48. Nuts. So there's this seesaw. So Yaakov understands that he needs to do something to ensure that Esav doesn't have a reason spiritually to defeat him. So he does two things. The first thing Yaakov does is he appreciates the beracha that was given to him. We know that when God blesses a person, the beracha that God gives is if you appreciate it. You know, the famous, my grandpa told me many jokes, and he always told me the joke with this half smile on his face, which I think I inherited. My kids can always tell when I'm joking, even if other people are not sure if I'm serious, because I have a tell. It's a good thing I don't play poker. Ready for this? You know, Jewish guy gets a gift from his grandma, two ties. He's going to visit his grandma for the holidays, so he brings a tie, walks in, nice suit, beautiful tie, his grandma walks in, grandma says, what, the other one you don't like? Every Jewish child is like shrugging their shoulders together with us right now. And the second joke he loved to tell was of a husband whose wife keeps telling him that he needs to buy her a birthday present. Anyway, so she she waits for the next birthday, and there's a beautiful envelope that comes in the mail. It says, to address to her in the back, it says, from your dear husband. And she opens it up, and it has a brand new, beautiful plot on Har HaZetim, a burial plot on the Mount of Olives. Anyway, she's like, okay, look, he bought a gift, not the best one. But maybe slowly, slowly. Let's see what he gets. Anyway, next year comes, she waits, no present. She turns to her husband, she says, what happened? Where's my present? He said, last year I bought you a present, you didn't use it. It's one of my grandpa's favorites. What makes you want to give to people? How much they appreciate what you give when you give it? Yeah? If you give someone something and they're like, oh, I wanted the 14 Pro Max. I guess I can make this work. You think to yourself, never again. That's what you think to yourself, right? No gifts, no more for you. No soup for you. Khalas, you're out. If the person thanks you, something else. You know, this idea, you have a person who comes to collect money for tzedakah, and you give them $100, and the person's like, really, sir, I saw your house, I saw your car, you think you could give more? Give me the $100. Here's a dollar. But if the person is effusive, thank you so much, unbelievable, you think to yourself, this is a good guy, next time I want to give him again, or maybe next time I want to give him more. Yaakov understands that he has this wonderful beracha. He needs to illustrate that he respects, that he honors, that he's grateful for that beracha. So what does he do? He honors, respects, and is grateful for even the smallest blessing. For even a couple of small knickknacks that he leaves on the other side of the river. And Yaakov understands that this is not something he needs anyone else for. This is a journey he needs to make himself. It's a process that he needs to do himself. It's an awareness, it's a respect he needs to do himself. Because no one else could do this for you. No one else can change the way that you feel. That's the first answer, but I think that there's a much deeper answer. You know what Yaakov was doing? He was metaphysically, he was spiritually showing Esav that he respected him. Because what was Esav's role in the world post that beracha? In a certain way, Yitzchak, when he gave the beracha to Yaakov Avinu, he was jumping forward in time to the time of Mashiach. When those who serve God will continue to serve God, and those who didn't up until that point, what will their connection with God be? What will their connection with the Jewish people be post-Mashiach? So people think, oh, they're going to all be Jewish slaves. No. That's not the point at all. In the time of Mashiach, when the truth is evident to everybody, but there are people out there who don't know Torah, mitzvot, they don't understand, but they know it's right, so what will they do? They'll turn to a Jewish person and say, let me do that for you. You can study Torah, you can pray, you can do these mitzvot in a time of utter spirituality with the time of Mashiach, where there are no wars and there's no greed. All there is a desire to do the right thing. What will happen is people that have not been trained will come to people and intern for them willingly. Let me do some of the things that you don't need to do so you can focus on the things that you should do. Yaakov respects the vessels. He says, he puts out into the world this concept that Esav's job is not menial, it's not unimportant, it's not small, it's worth the time of the tzaddik to go back to get them. Because that's a valuable investment. And within that, what does he do? He allows space for Esav to have a role to play on the same team. What a powerful lesson that is. In the world of work, in the world of family, in the world of machloket, to be able to figure out a way, even if it's a small way, for someone to work. You know, I always think about this idea. There's an interesting halakha, and you have to know and ask a rabbi when it applies. But there are certain instances where a person is avel, they're in mourning, and they're allowed to be at a wedding. Again, ask your local Orthodox rabbi. And what do we say? We have a very strange law. When a person is going to that wedding that they have to go to for a family member, whatever the case might be, they go to the wedding and they act as a waiter. They help serve the food, they bring something to the table, etc., etc. But not as a fake thing, as a real thing. They actually have to help. in order to not be there as a guest enjoying, I'm here, I'm working, so to speak. And I always thought to myself how, look, there's a way that you can include someone in your simcha, even if he's only there as a waiter. He's still part of the wedding. You know, you don't like this person. You don't want to, it's a family member. You don't want to hang out with them. You don't want to go on vacation together. They get on your nerves. Figure out a way to include them in your simcha. Figure out a way for them to be, for you, pachim ktanim, to find some value in them that it's worth your time and your effort to make this happen. You don't like the way they are. You don't want to sit together at the table. You don't want to be together on vacation. Fine. So do something. Figure out a way where the interaction is more limited, where they play a functional role, where you know you'll be grateful to them because they helped you with this thing. And let that become the baseline, or at least the beginning of an attempt to be able to keep or to create that relationship. But my friends, like everything else, that could not be done with Yaakov's children or his wives or his servants until it happened within himself. Vayivater Yaakov levado, he went back to go get the pachim ktanim. What or who are your pachim ktanim? And how soon could you get in a boat, ferry across, and bring them with you? Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen.